You're listening to DNA ID, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family, Missing Persons, Scene of the Crime, Zodiac Speaking,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
Citizen Detective,
and
Campus Killings.
All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
May 18, 1976, Grand Bay, Mobile County, Alabama. A group of teenage boys were fishing in the creek just below a low trestle bridge that carried two-lane potter-tracked road over Sessions Creek. Peering down, one of them noticed some trash bags, mostly submerged in the shallow, rocky, weedy water. I'm reading here from reporter Shelby Myers' reporting on Fox 10 News Mobile's website, quote, Fox 10 News tracked down a man who was just 14 years old in 1976. He said he and a group of fishing buddies discovered the Jane Doe. The man said, The guys came by the house and they wanted to go fishing, and we always went down to that little creek down Potter Tract Road. We thought someone had thrown garbage over the bridge, but then one of the guys said, Well, there's legs sticking out of that thing. So we thought, okay, somebody's thrown a mannequin into the creek. Then the other guy got a stick, a long limb, and pulled it over to the bank, and that's when we see it was a real person. The man didn't want to be identified, but said May 18, 1976 was a surreal day. We didn't tear the bag open. We didn't touch it. We just basically got the heck out of there and went and told our parents, he said. Even though I was 14 years old, for a few nights I still couldn't sleep in my own room. It freaked me out that I had to sleep on the floor in my parents' room, the man said. That was all from Fox 10 News. The boy's parents called the police, who came out and used a small rowboat to approach the body, partially wrapped in trash bags. It was a woman. She appeared on the older side, with wrinkles, dark hair worn short, a large mole near her left smile line, and some large brown age spots on her face. She had been dead for about 2 days. Her immediately obvious cause of death, confirmed by the medical examiner Dr. Leroy Riddick, was a gunshot wound to the back of the head. The projectile was recovered from inside her skull, and horrifyingly, her hands had been cut off after her death and were not found with her body. Trash bags had been wrapped around her head and wrists, likely to contain any blood oozing from those locations. Dr. Riddick observed that her mouth was devoid of teeth and her dentures were also missing, and she had no identification on her. Jane Doe could not be identified despite distinguishing characteristics. She was 5'3" tall, 140 pounds, and estimated to be between 50 and 65 years old. She had green eyes, hysterectomy scars on her abdomen, the large facial mole I mentioned, and was wearing a bright yellow sleeveless ribbed top and green pants. Her bra had come apart in the back, apparently because the strap was nearly threadbare. She wore no underwear and her feet were bare. Dr. Riddick was not able to detect any signs of sexual assault in a rape kit he did on Jane Doe. Witnesses located by the Mobile County Sheriff's Office reported seeing two different vehicles in the area after dark right before Jane Doe was found. One was a pickup truck and one was a light-colored sedan. Sergeant J.T. Thornton, who helped solve this case, believes that the sedan was the more likely vehicle, since Jane Doe's bloody body parts were wrapped in plastic. Someone didn't want to get blood inside their car interior. Unfortunately, the witnesses didn't see the license plate of either vehicle. The sedan was seen at the trestle bridge where Jane Doe was found, and drag marks at the scene and post-mortem abrasions and contusions on Jane Doe's body indicated that she was dragged to the edge of the bridge and thrown over the railing into the creek below. Blood droplets on the concrete illustrated the trajectory of Jane Doe being dragged and hoisted up and over the side. To the investigators, That meant that the person who had dumped Jane Doe in the creek had acted alone. The Mobile County Sheriff's Office went through all the typical methods employed at the time to try to identify the unidentified murder victim. They placed notices in the local newspapers, asked the local TV channels to cover the story, and sent teletypes to law enforcement agencies in neighboring jurisdictions. Of course, they requested the public to call in any tips about who Jane Doe might be. Some tips were received and written up by deputies on index cards for follow-up, but none led anywhere. Leads such as the vehicles seen by witnesses quickly dried up. And that was about all they could do. There was no internet at this time. News was regional. Information sharing between agencies was limited. Mobile County Sheriff Sergeant J.T. Thornton grew up in Grand Bay and always knew the lore of the Jane Doe found in the creek not far from the Mississippi state line. He began reviewing the 1976 Jane Doe case in 2014. He became convinced that he knew who had killed Jane Doe, but he still couldn't identify her. Starting in 2021, he worked with the Mobile County Sheriff's Office in-house forensic genealogist and co-founder of Moxie Forensic Investigations, Olivia McCarter, with the goal of identifying Jane Doe. In 2022, they released an image of Jane Doe, created by well-known forensic artist Carl Koppelman. She was wearing a yellow turtleneck sweater, but no one called in an identification. The next step, of course, was to obtain DNA from Jane Doe and enter her into the CODIS Unidentified Human Remains database. This had never been done, and they soon found out why. Back in 1976, blood cards were not collected at autopsies, and Jane Doe wasn't around anymore. Her body had been donated to the Anatomical Donations Program at the University of South Alabama. When the students were done studying her in 1979, she was cremated and buried in a mass grave on Springfield Avenue in Mobile. DNA was not available from her person. Sergeant Thornton was extremely disappointed, but decided to take a look at some of the physical items that remained in evidence. But there was nothing. No clothing, no projectile, no rape kit, nothing. Physical items relating to the Jane Doe case were just gone, either cremated with her, destroyed, whether by a massive hurricane or deliberately, or lost when the sheriff's department relocated from the old courthouse. Any hopes of obtaining her DNA were dashed. But Sergeant Thornton didn't give up. He checked what he referred to as the catacombs of the MCSO's evidence storage facility. And there, in a jumbled box of stuff, he found a ceramic dental mold the original medical examiner had used to take dental impressions of Jane Doe's gums. Since she had no fingers to obtain prints from, the only way they could hope to name her back in 1976 was from someone recognizing her through a sketch or autopsy photos, or perhaps matching her jaw to her dentures on the off chance that some were located. That seems like an awful long shot, and no one knows exactly why the dental mold was taken, but taken it was. It was in rough shape, though. I was told it was wrapped in paper, but was covered in rodent droppings and smelled stale and damp. But there were tiny visible particles of some unidentified material clinging to the mold. They sent the dental mold off to nonprofit lab Intermountain Forensics for attempted DNA extraction. It was such a shot in the dark, Ms. McCarter was convinced it would not work. The mold had been swabbed in the past and no physical evidence located. Even if they found something now with better technology, the medical examiner might not have even worn gloves back then, and all kinds of evidence techs could have handled the mold and contaminated it. And saliva from a corpse 45 years earlier would no way still be on the dental mold and usable. And it wasn't. Something better was skin cells. Skin cells that contained DNA. Intermountain Forensics carefully gathered all the cells they could from the mold, using the cutting-edge MVAC DNA gathering device that is revolutionizing DNA evidence collection. Rather than manually swabbing an item for invisible DNA, which can be random and result in spots being missed, the MVAC is just as it sounds, a wet vacuum system that sprays sterile solution onto the item being analyzed and then sucks up any loosened DNA-containing particles with the solution. It works on all kinds of surfaces, whether porous, uneven, textured, rough, or what have you, where swabbing comes up short. The DNA-containing material can then be separated from the solution, and voila. Olivia McCarter told AL.com, quote, "It worked better than I ever anticipated. There was zero contamination and was 100% female DNA," end quote. The DNA was uncompromised and usable. From 145 nanograms of DNA found on the dental mold, Intermountain Forensics was able to conduct whole genome sequencing to work up a SNP profile for Jane Doe. By the way, I was curious about how all this works given that the dental mold was exposed to rodent droppings. So I posed the question to Danny Helwig, Director of Laboratory Development for Intermountain Forensics, about how they were able to obtain a full profile for Jane Doe despite the potential for contamination by the rodent droppings. Here's his response, quote, "After we sequence the entire genome, we use bioinformatics that pulls out the human-specific single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, that go into the upload files for genetic genealogy. Those are all human-specific. So any contaminating DNA wouldn't have any influence on the SNPs that we pull and the output we create for GEDmatch and ftDNA," end quote. Okay, even I can understand that. Once she had the SNP profile, Ms. McCarter loaded the profile into GEDmatch. The results presented a challenging start. The closest DNA relative, a male, shared 106 centimorgans of DNA with Jane Doe, the equivalent of a second cousin twice removed. His grandparents shared great-grandparents with Jane Doe. But he was by far the closest match. The next closest DNA relatives shared much lesser amounts of DNA. But there were matches who were not related to each other, representing both sides of Jane Doe's family tree. Ms. McCarter told me that the difficulty was that Jane Doe's maternal line exhibited quite a bit of endogamy, and it was challenging to sort that all out. She focused on the paternal side and used a tool called What Are the Odds on the very helpful DNA Painter website, which pointed her in the right direction. What Are the Odds is a probability tool that assesses the amounts of DNA shared between the subject and multiple DNA relatives to make an educated guess about where the subject falls in the tree. It took 19 days for Ms. McCarter to reverse engineer Jane Doe's family tree to figure out who she was. 19 days of hell, she called it. Finally, in April 2023, she found a woman in the right location on the family tree who had no proof of life after 1976 and no death certificate. She had just vanished. Her name was Ada Elizabeth Fritz. Investigators learned that Ada never had any children, remember the hysterectomy scars on her body, but still had one remaining relative, a nephew in California. He was the son of Ada's only sibling, her brother John, who died in the 1990s. Orange County, California deputies knocked on this octogenarian nephew's door and showed him a photo of Jane Doe taken at her autopsy. He said, "Yep, that's my Aunt Ada." A DNA sample from him confirmed it. He shared a level of DNA with Jane Doe consistent with an aunt-nephew relationship. So who was Ada Elizabeth Fritz? She was born on September 22, 1914, in Sheridan, Wyoming, to parents Verna Truelove Fritz from Kansas and Edgar Fritz from Indiana. Her dad was 17 years older than her mother, and he died when Ada was just 14 years old. Ada's brother John was 2 years her senior, and the two were close. There's a photo of her and her brother in the 1940s, wearing overalls and laughingly licking lollipops. Ada was a good student, mentioned in the Star Tribune after making the fourth grade honor roll at Wilson School in Casper, Wyoming. But she didn't finish high school, probably because money was tight without her dad Edgar around. After he died, she and her brother lived with an aunt for a time. In the 1940s, Ada lived with the family as a maid and nanny. At some point, she relocated to Oregon, where she spent much of her adult life working in the laundry facility of Oregon State Mental Hospital. Ada was married twice. Family photos show her and her husband Elmer Earl Schubert, a pipefitter. The two traveled quite a bit together. According to what Ms. McCarter learned from Ada's nephew and his wife, Ada was adventurous and liked going on hunting and fishing trips rather than staying home. Any salmon she caught on trips up north, she would can and distribute to her family. But in 1969, 53-year-old Elmer took his own life by shooting himself in the chest with a .22 caliber rifle. Ada was the one to find him dead in their home. That must have been devastating for her, and she did not tell her family what had happened, just that Elmer was dead. After he passed, she spent some time traveling and remained very close with her mother, who was her best friend. The two went and stayed with her nephew and his wife to help them through the newborn stage when they had their first baby. Then Ada married Alfred Havill in 1975. The two moved around and didn't really have to fix a dress for too long. It was during this marriage to Alfred that Ada lost contact with her brother John. He blamed her husband. It's not really clear what happened between Ada and Alfred, but it appears she left her second husband. We know that her mother visited a single Ada at her home in Batesville, Arkansas, where Verna suddenly took ill. She died at the end of March 1976. 48 days later, 61-year-old Ada was found dead in Mobile County, Alabama. Her nephew told the investigators that his father, John, Ada's brother, had assumed Ada's husband, Alfred, had cut them out of her life, and he didn't realize that she was missing. No missing persons report was ever filed for her. The nephew regretted the loss of his Aunt Ada, whom he fondly remembered spending summers with hunting and fishing, and as a helpful, loving, and caring person. So how did Ada end up dead in Sessions Creek in May 1976? Sergeant Thornton suspects a Grand Bay man named Henderson James Williams of killing Ada. In 1994, 65-year-old Williams had murdered his own mother, Irma Williams, police said, in order to have access to her life savings of about $100,000. He killed her in her home in Moss Point, Mississippi, by bludgeoning her with a hard object, put her in his trunk where her blood was later found, weighted her body down with chains, and dumped her in water off Hall Road in Grand Bay, Alabama. This was just 1/4 mile from his Hall Road home and about 5 miles from where Jane Doe had been found in the same small town. Two boys swimming in the pond found Irma within a day. Williams was convicted of 89-year-old Irma's murder in 1996, sentenced to life in prison, and died in Parchman State Penitentiary in 2008. In Irma's case, Williams had also cut off her hands and removed her dentures. Police had found burnt bones they suspected were Irma's hand bones in a burn pile behind Williams' house in Mobile County. Sergeant Thornton was convinced that Williams killed his Jane Doe because of the startling parallels in her case and the case of Irma Williams, and he was not the first member of law enforcement to notice the similarities. An article I found in the Sun Herald, dated May 26, 1994, reads, quote, "The arrest of a Mobile County man in the slaying of his elderly mother stirred new interest in a 1976 murder because both victims had their hands cut off and were found near the same pond. Investigators reviewed long-dormant files in the death of Mrs. X after the arrest Saturday of 65-year-old Henderson James Williams," end quote. Jane Doe was Mrs. X, and investigators broached the subject of her murder with Williams. But he refused to answer any questions about Jane Doe and whether he was involved in her death. Once Jane Doe was identified as Ada in early 2023, Sergeant Thornton told AL.com that he did everything he could to connect Ada Fritz and Henderson Williams, but it was impossible. Williams was dead and couldn't answer any questions. His home in 1976 had changed hands multiple times. Floods from hurricanes had ravaged the area, and no one still living knows anything about Williams being linked to Ada, who wasn't a resident of the area. She was likely just a tourist in this whole neck of the woods. Olivia McCarter said that by this time in her life, Ada had retired from her hospital job, her mother had passed away, she had left her second husband, and she was finally able to pursue her love of travel and outdoor adventure. The theory is that she was visiting the Gulf Coast on a fishing trip, as she was known to love extended fishing and hunting voyages, but we will never know. It is believed possible that she was just in the wrong place at the wrong time and ran across Henderson Williams somehow. Ada seemed to be a loving and trusting person who had a lot of sadness in her life. Perhaps she placed her trust in the wrong man. Sergeant Thornton told me that he believes the motive was robbery. Ada was not found with any valuables or possessions of her own other than her clothing, and Henderson Williams had a history of murder for money. Besides his mother's homicide, Henderson Williams had been convicted of murder in Newport News, Virginia, where he was from, in 1973. This was the murder of Dennis Wade Turlington, stabbed 3 times in the chest in an argument over a girl, as phrased by the local papers. Williams called police a half hour after the stabbing and turned himself in. He was convicted, but spent only 28 days in jail for unknown reasons. the Newport News Agency didn't have the case file for that homicide any longer, as they had lost a bunch of old files in a flood. And no one knows why he would have been released so quickly on a murder conviction. If he had been kept in prison, Ada, whom he killed 3 years later, would very likely be alive. The investigators on Ada's team, the MCSO and Intermountain Forensics, consider their identification of her as something of a miracle. Ada had been shot in the head and her fingers and dentures removed to thwart her identification. Then she was cremated and buried in a mass grave. Her clothes and other evidentiary items disappeared. But now, using an incredible piece of modern technology, DNA obtained from skin cells nearly 50 years old on a piece of evidence that no one can explain the existence of, and which was improperly packaged and stuck in a box, was successfully collected, and a single DNA profile obtained, leading to the name Ada Elizabeth Fritz. As a side note, one of the early tips that came in about Jane Doe in 1976 was from a woman named Fannie Mae Copeland Gaunt, who thought Jane Doe could be her missing friend. She wasn't. But 2 years later, Fannie Mae herself became a murder victim in a case that remains unsolved. Sergeant Thornton told me that Fannie Mae's case file is so scant as to be useless. Fannie Mae was born in 1908 and was slain on April 3, 1978. When she died, she was a widow, and her two children have since died as well. It seems likely that her murderer will continue to escape justice. Thank you so much to Olivia McCarter, Danny Helwig, and Sergeant Thornton for speaking with me about this case. Recently, I let listeners know about a new benefit available to them called an Abjack Insider subscription that's available through Apple Podcasts. An Abjack Insider subscription will give listeners ad-free access to every bit of DNA ID content published, both past episodes and future episodes. It will also give you benefits like early access and bonus content. Head over to Apple Podcasts and click on the DNA ID show page or the Abjack Entertainment channel to start a free trial. Thanks for listening to this episode of DNA ID. If you'd like to listen to the show ad-free and help support the show in the process, please head over to patreon.com/DNAID. And if you're interested in some fun DNA ID merch, visit the store at customizedgirl.com/s/DNAID podcast. To contact the show, please email us at dnaidpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on social media at dnaidpodcast on Instagram, at dnaidpodcast on Twitter, or on Facebook at facebook.com/dnaidpodcast. Finally, if you want to visit our website, go to dnaidpodcast.com. You'll be able to get all the episodes of the show, leave comments on episodes that I can respond to, and you can even leave voicemails. You'll get all the latest news about the show and important updates. Find links to our social media, merch, and a lot more. It's really your one-stop shop for everything DNA ID. DNA ID is written, researched, and hosted by me, Jessica Betancourt. It's produced by me and Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Music by Connor Betancourt. Check out our other collaborative podcasts, Scene of the Crime, Missing Persons, and Beyond Bizarre True Crime.